Welcome to the 12th House Podcast. I'm Michelle, the co-host and your head witch in charge here at Holisticism. I started Holisticism to help creative, intuitive, spiritual people actualize through their sacred work. And at the 12th House, that's what we talk about all day long. We give you tools to do whatever it is that you're here to do. That's going to be intuitive business practices like sales, marketing, branding. That also means learning about things like self-knowledge, spirituality, creativity, everything that you need to really expand as a person. I think that running a business is one of the biggest opportunities to level up and grow as a spiritual being. So join us to talk about everything you could possibly need to get the expansion pack and jump to the next level. Think of us as your metaphysical BFF who's kind of obsessed with productivity and intuitive business, but definitely has your human design chart memorized. We're pretty fun. I think you're going to love it. And let's get into today's episode. Welcome, everyone who's listening, and also Katie, to the 12th House Podcast. Katie, you're our new podcast producer, and by default, you now have to hang out with me on the mic sometimes. I'm so excited and happy that you're here.
It is an honor and a privilege. I'm so grateful to be here and excited for this philosophy, excited to be in the 12th House. Plus, we just recorded some episodes in there. That was just a blast, to be honest with you. I'm very excited to be here.
I couldn't echo the sentiment more or more loudly. And we just really went hard on the 12th House Plus. So you can go and subscribe to it if you want. But in the meantime, we are here to talk about one of our Friday philosophies. We're here with our new podcast producer extraordinaire. And that means that Wallace is no longer our podcast producer. And we just wanted to say we love her. You probably heard on the last couple of episodes how we were sort of winding down and talking about Wallace moving forward and moving on to getting her graduate degree at NYU, my alma mater. She's getting a really cool, interesting degree in the convergence of art and technology and media. And I mean, I couldn't think of a better thing for and a better person to be leading the charge on the future of the culture. So we miss Wallace. We love her. And we're really excited to have Katie here.
I know. We love Wallace. Huge shoes to fill. And congrats to her for going to grad school and starting a new chapter. And I have a feeling that she will be back here to talk to us as a guest at some point in the future, because I would love it, definitely.
Yeah. And that's something you're going to notice some changes. We got a new director at the helm. We also know ourselves even better now at the podcast, and we've been loving doing these Friday philosophies and frameworks and meaning making systems. And it sounds like you really like them too. And in addition to having Katie on the podcast, we're also going to have some friends of the pod on. So you'll probably notice some names that you love and you know, and maybe you'll meet some new people too, who will be coming on to have some conversations with us about these Friday philosophies, not interview podcasts, but hanging with friends. More will be revealed. But let's get into today's Friday philosophy. Katie, had you heard of the Semmelweis effect when I put it in our pitch document?
I had not. And then I almost texted you a screenshot of this today, but in true projector rabbit hole way, I went down a rabbit hole and I was going to send you a screenshot of what I had queued up, but I listened to so many history podcasts about this and I read two articles, which I'm going to save for the end because there's one part that I'm especially excited to talk to you specifically about that I haven't even told you about yet. But it was completely new to me until you put it in there, but fascinating.
Yes. Okay. I can't wait to hear what your research rabbit hole led you to. Obsessed with that. I feel like so many of these frameworks, they're things that we unconsciously know as phenomenon, but that we don't have a term to sort of like ground ourselves down in. And I like putting a name to a face, if you will. And I think the Semmelweis effect will be really familiar to a lot of people who are listening right now. And the way that I'm thinking about it and why I wanted to bring it up was because so much of what we do at Holisticism is about doing things differently and going against the grain a lot of the time. And not because we're just like rebels without a cause, but because we find out new information potentially that can make our life, our jobs, the way we have an impact deeper or easier or more fun or more magical. And it's not always easy to introduce that to other people. So I think that this mental model will really hit home with you if you're considering doing things differently or you're trying to do things differently in the world. So Semmelweis effect, and obviously it was named after a person. It was named after a doctor, Ignaz Semmelweis. He was a Hungarian physician. And in 1847, he was actually an obstetrician. And he was treating so many women who ended up dying from what they called childbed fever. They would give birth and then these women would get really, really sick and get a fever and die. And he found that when doctors, this is gross, washed their hands, disinfected their hands after a C-section or after, you know, delivering a baby and then working with a woman afterwards to either sew her up or just make sure everything was in place, by using a chlorine solution, so not just regular water or like a light rinse, that the rates, mortality rates fell tenfold. And he brought his, he's like, oh my God, this is amazing. I'm going to be saving so many lives. This is incredible. So he brings his findings to his fellow obstetricians, and they, the way that they looked at this man, they looked at him like he was absolutely bananas batshit. And that also he's a stinky turd who was incredibly offensive to them. You like, he, they looked at him like he just told them that their mom smelled like an armpit. They just couldn't believe that as gentlemen, their hands would ever be dirty because doctors were considered gentlemen and gentlemen had clean hands. Gentlemen could not possibly spread disease. It just was incongruous with their way of seeing and understanding the world. And so horror, oh my God, it's actually so tragic. Semmelweis had a really sad life and existence. He wasn't believed by anyone. For 20 years, he basically discovered germ theory 20 years before Louis Pasteur did. And he tried to get his fellow obstetricians to wash their hands to save the lives of women and babies. And they did not listen to him until 20 years later when germ theory was discovered. And we realized that we can transfer germs from one patient to another if we don't wash our hands, if we don't wash our materials like forceps. His daughter, in fact, actually ended up dying because she contracted an illness at a hospital after a doctor was not washing his hands. So he had a really sad life and he died. He died with everyone kind of calling him a crazy person. And his concept of hand washing with chlorine was just ridiculed. And here we are many moons later, the only way to fly, washing your hands. But before I get into the effect, Katie, any thoughts, feelings, vibes?
Well, yeah. So in my research, Wormhole, you covered most of it, but I have a few color commentary things to add. And one of them was there's this great episode of a BBC podcast where they interviewed someone about this, because I think a lot of history podcasts who had covered this in like 2018 or further back even did a lot of re-airing this around COVID for obvious reasons. But in some of those that I listened to, one talked about how he figured this out. There were two hospitals, and one hospital, the rates of that were very close by, one hospital where the rates of the mothers dying was astronomical with the one he was in, and the other one was less. So he kept doing, you know, using as a focus group. And he thought at one point it was this bell that would ring. And he was like, maybe that's what it is. And it, when it wasn't that, he was heartbroken. He tried all these different experiments. And then he figured out that it was the hand washing and tried to tell people that. And what I think that I didn't understand when I first learned about this through you was that this is a tendency to believe truth when it's unpleasant, you know, like it's unpleasant. People didn't want to have to use this chlorine solution. And in this BBC episode, they talk about how that chlorine solution was the best he could come up with. You know what I mean? They didn't have Dial mm-hmm. soap. So it was kind of annoying. It smelled bad. It was intense. They didn't really like doing it. So they were like, I think we're all set. It wasn't the loud sound, so it's probably not this. So no, thank mm-hmm. you. I don't want to do it. And I thought that was really interesting. And then there's this other really sad fact that he eventually had to go to a mental institution because he would go to different hospitals and try to tell people this and try to help. And it just really wasn't received well. And another part of the reasoning around that is because I didn't realize how bad conditions in hospitals were at that time. They talk about just the smell being so terrible and how there was sawdust on the floor and operating rooms to for the blood to get absorbed by. And just, oh, this fact was really, truly wild. They said that in hospital beds, in this person who was recovering in their hospital bed, there was a mushroom growth and all of these little like,
oh my God,
molds, because that, and they just, ugh, no one batted an eye because that was just what was happening at the time. So he, you know, he obviously wasn't believed. He died in this mental institution and they thought he died of some sort of disease. I forget exactly what it was, but then someone writing a biography of him found out that it was actually, he was beat up. Like that was really how he died. I know.
It's so tragic. And yeah, I told you the story, but I totally buried the lead. The Semmelweis effect, now that, you know, his legacy is this concept that, like Katie said, we have a tendency to reject evidence, new evidence that contradicts our established beliefs, especially if it's uncomfortable or if it's quote unquote painful to embody, which means that we often dismiss new ideas that are difficult for us to comprehend. And it's technically like under the umbrella of confirmation bias, because denialism leads us to ignore objective evidence, even when it could bring transformative improvement into our lives. And, you know, confirmation bias is basically we find evidence for what we want to believe. So if we want to believe that washing our hands doesn't actually help with maternal mortality rates, well, we could definitely find evidence for that, but we could probably find more evidence to prove that actually it does really help. And this shows up not just in medicine or science, but global warming. It wasn't that long ago that people were I guess people still do deny global warming, right? It's very inconvenient. It's an inconvenient truth. We don't want to have to change, but there's enough evidence that proves that that thing is that's happening. COVID being airborne. Do you remember when everyone was saying, oh, COVID is just like, it's, you know, it's not, it couldn't possibly be in the air. It's on your groceries. So you got to lice all your groceries. It became so much more complex and scary when we realized this disease wasn't just something that was passed in droplets, but that it could be in the air in the grocery store. And it took a really long time. And there's still people that don't believe that. I think, honestly, racism in America, that was a hard fact for a lot of people to come to terms with. And many people, I think, up until 2020 would vehemently deny that racism still existed in America, although we have tons of evidence to point in the opposite direction. And then maybe a funny one, bulletproof coffee actually being really good for you. We've been told for so long, especially our, you know, babies of the 80s and 90s, that fat, butter, you got to stay away from. Margarine, that is a health food. Butter, that'll kill you. But we've seen that actually when people eat healthy fats, it can actually be really helpful to their health. It can have positive side effects. Do you have any other examples of how Semmelweis effect shows up in the world, Katie, or at least for you?
Yeah, well, you know, the part that was most interesting to me about this one and this one specifically, and the first two definitely fall into this category, but I was getting caught on the tendency to refuse a belief that is unpleasant, that makes your life more complicated. Mm-hmm. I can think of a lot of ways where I've thought that I could never do something, like the bulletproof coffee example of, I could never move to New York. I could never figure that out and have enough money and learn the subway. But I did, you know? But that one, it's not necessarily, it doesn't make my life unpleasant. So I was getting stuck on that one detail.
I like that definition of something that's unpleasant. I don't know if that's the totally congruent description in the dictionary of the Semmelweis reflex, but I do like that framing of it. So I guess difficult ideas, difficulty doesn't, like painful is difficult, but difficult is not always painful. Like totally. It's difficult to conceptualize yourself in a new place, not with your family or not with your boyfriend. If you're moving from Michigan to New York, that's a difficult thing to even imagine starting your life over. And maybe even painful, but yeah, to your point, you figured it out and it's new evidence that makes you question your established belief around yourself and what you're capable of, but you go and do it. It doesn't mean that it's true, you know?
Yeah. And I think often anything uncharted, even if it's just for you, is by nature a little bit, there's a little bit of discomfort excitement sometimes too. And not that there has to be, but I think, yeah, like you said, just opening up your brain to see it a different way is important and also can be uncomfortable.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of a more precise imagining around like limiting beliefs, that language that like really grinds my gears, that so many like, you know, new age coaches or internet marketers will say like, oh, it's just your limiting beliefs. But yeah. I mean, to a degree, that's kind of true, right? And I think some always reflex, it does reflect that, oh, what did you think was true? Well, if I show you, if we find evidence for that not to potentially be true, are you willing to part with it? Are you willing to part with that way of seeing the world, or at least try this new way of seeing the world? And I was thinking about this in context, of course, of like our listeners, hey guys, and us as creatives and intuitive people and people who are making things and who are always trying to self-actualize through our work, right? To understand ourselves more deeply and examine ourselves more deeply. And Semmelweis reflex, to me, it brings us just this opportunity to investigate what evidence of doing things differently we're ignoring, we're actively turning our head away from, because we've quote unquote always done it a different way before or another way before. So for example, like the concept that you think you always have to use social media if you have a business. Well, really? Do you have to? Like, sure, we know that that's a great way to run your business and that can be really helpful, but maybe there's evidence for you personally that it's not the best thing for you. You're actually not making sales. It's decreasing your quality of life when it comes to your mental health. It's taking up way too much of your time and it's not yielding any results for you. Maybe the evidence actually points to the opposite direction, that you shouldn't use it. Or maybe something that we can investigate is the idea of not being stressed about work all the time. Do we think or believe that if we have work, that therefore equals stress, anxiety, and pressure? What if we investigate that? Is it possible? Is there evidence that we can find that work can actually be really enjoyable and pleasant and not take up all of our brain space and time? I could go on and on and on about this, but Katie, what do you think?
Well, I just really like it. I think being malleable, we talked about this a little bit in the 12th house plus of, it's something that you get a bigger sample size the more you're like, wow, I thought it had to be that way. Turns out there's another way to see it. It opens you up to be like, wow, there's probably a lot more things like that that I'm not even clocking at this point, that with time I will. And so that I do think this is in some ways connected to experience a bit, because it happened. The more it happens, the easier it is. You know, the uncomfortable piece goes away if you're just like, oh, I turns out I could be wrong. And I know what that's like, and I know what it's like to learn.
That just reminded me, there is like a subtle difference between being open to being wrong and assuming that you're always wrong and that you don't know better. And that is a challenging, I guess, tightrope to walk, right? Of like being humble about what you know and knowing that there's so much that you don't know and that you couldn't possibly know, but you do know some stuff. And I think maybe that's like the whole point of holisticism is, I can't necessarily understand the mysteries of the universe, but I can't hope to understand the mysteries of myself and who I am. And when I know myself, then I'll always have solid earth to come back to, even if the information around me or the evidence around me that I'm getting introduced to is changing all the time. You know what I mean?
Wow, I really like a lot. Do you see it as a spectrum of what you were saying of believing you don't know anything? Because that can be self-deprecating and hold you back. And then the opposite of that being also problematic, believing you do know everything. Is it trying to get to a center? Is that how you look at it?
Maybe, yeah. I think, trying to gauge and having that be like a mutable thing, right? Not stuck in the middle exactly, but trying to always find our equilibrium as the scales are moving in one direction versus another. Like when I talk about, I don't know, coding a computer, I am like, I don't know anything. I really don't know anything about this. Although I do know a little bit, I just have to pull it out of the recesses of my mind. Versus when I talk about something like, let's say archetypes, like I know a lot about archetypes, but there's still so much for me to learn that I need to remain humble and open to how other people interpret them. And I think also just, you know, I'll speak from the eye. For me, it's being open to how other people's evidence while also putting that into my own algorithm of how I understand the world and deciding, okay, do I want to take in that evidence and completely change course? Does that totally change how I see things? Or does that actually just build a stronger picture for me because it was like a missing puzzle piece that I need? Or something else? Maybe actually it's not that valuable. It's not an input that I'm going to consider. So I'm going to throw it away. That's Themelwe's reflex. Like, you can't just totally, I think a lot of the time we're one extreme or the other. We either take everything that everyone else says because they know better than us, or we dig our head in the sand and we're like, no, you don't understand what I'm trying to do. You don't get it. Like, we just don't take the feedback or advice. I'll speak from the eye. I did it, especially in my 20s.
It takes a level of discernment. I think I probably err on the side of being like, most people know more, except in a few areas where I've just had a lot of experience or read a lot. Mm-hmm. Then I fall on the other side, which I still could very much be wrong there, maybe even more so with the bias that I have. So it's definitely breaks up my brain to try to think about it in a way that is good. I'm having a Semmelweis effect of the Semmelweis.
One thing about me is that I am very lazy, and it's confusing because I'm really good at working really hard, but in my core, in my soul, I am really a slug. I'm a slug on the sofa. That is my true calling. And the more often I can be blob, the happier I tend to be. And so running a business doesn't necessarily work cohesively, isn't necessarily synergistic with big blob energy, but I found it's actually like more doable than one might think. And that's why I created Creators Casting In. One of our Notion for Magical Baddies classes, meaning it's taught live inside of Notion, and you get tons of Notion templates to go along with the course. It's our Notion for Magical Baddies class that I created for the creators among us who make content and want to get paid for it. If you're a writer, if you're a podcaster, if you're a teacher, a guide, if you're someone who wants to run a community or has a community, but you haven't figured out how to make it a fair energetic exchange for the work that you do, Creators Cashing In is for you. And really, like I said, I'm lazy. The reason I created it is because these businesses, while so fun, can be really emotionally exhausting and really just time intensive, especially if you're unorganized and you don't see how everything comes together. And for the nonlinear thinkers among us, myself included, that part, getting it all organized, prepped, systematized, can be really difficult. And in the muddling through every single day and always feeling like you're behind deadline and like you're not making enough money and you're not sure if the next step that you're making is the right one, not only does that just objectively suck, scientifically, it makes your creativity plummet by at least 400%, allegedly. And the point of Creators Cashing In is to help creatives like you and me, nonlinear thinkers, get organized, get clear, and monetize the incredible content and knowledge that they're already sharing with the world. So good news, Creators Cashing In is open, doors are opening, and I would love to have you in the course. I won't be teaching this again for at least another 6 months, but it's one of my favorite things to teach, and there's a ton that I've added into the course this time around. So if you're thinking of running a digital course, selling digital knowledge working products, building a community, monetizing your podcast or your email newsletter, this course is for you. I'd love for you to join us, and you can learn more at the link in our show notes. I wrote down some ways to avoid falling into Semmelweis reflex, but at least for me, falling on either side of the spectrum, it doesn't feel good. Like, it feels when I don't know anything, I'm giving my power away, and I feel adrift, like a loser, you know, like just out in the universe floating. And when I'm like so rigid in my beliefs, I feel I'm like white knuckling, you know, and I'm like fighting or getting defensive. And I think that for me, like those two feelings, they both feel really bad, and they are good flags that I'm going to like mark for myself next time I feel that.
Is this a little bit of Semmelweis reflex that's popping up for me right now in my life? Or is this something else?
Yeah, you're right. It never feels good to try to be debating, and even with yourself, or to try to, it takes a lot of energy, and it's just an energy expenditure that I would like to put that resource elsewhere if possible.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we'll get into some more ways to sort of, we'll land this plane with some like takeaways if, you know, you're wanting to explore some Semmelweis reflex in your own life. But I'm dying to hear about this historical anecdote that you have.
Well, I'll keep this tight because I want to hear some of your examples. But I read this and I was like, oh, Michelle's going to love this. You might already know this. So did you know that Abraham Lincoln's wife, Mary Todd Lincoln, she would have been in the North Node, to be honest with you.
She was kind of a witch.
Yeah, she sought out.
She was super intuitive.
Exactly. Yes, she sought out spiritualists, it says in this article, and she attended seances over the years, especially after.
Well, yeah, because her son died. Did you read Lincoln in the Bardo?
No, I didn't, but it's been on my list.
It's a really weird book. It was kind of hard for me to get through, but yeah, it's basically like, you know.
George Saunders, right?
Yeah, Lincoln's son.
I love him.
Dies, and it's about him hanging out with all the other spirits in the cemetery and like who's there.
Yeah, yeah. So she's, you know, she's definitely into this sort of thing before Abraham's death. And her husband, he's not, you know, he'll support her, but he's not really into it. And he would see all these mediums come in, and they'd come in and out of the White House, and he was aware of them, and they would know him, but they weren't really his friends. It says here he tolerated it, but he wasn't, you know, he thought it was harmless, and it comforted his wife, but that was that for him.
Wow. Cue the Taylor Swift for Mary Todd.
Yeah, totally. And anyway, so during that era, many people believed that the living were separated from the dead by a spiritual veil that could be lifted by a skilled medium. And then at the same time, many charlatans, of course, were, you know, taken advantage of because of their gullible, you know, just like anything, right? There was truth, and there was people taking advantage of people.
Asterix, go listen to our mediumship podcast episode on the 12th House Plus.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking. So anyway, this is the part that brings us all together, which is that one of these mediums enjoyed frequent access to the White House. This was, you know, someone who they were, I will say they were familiar friends. They weren't close, but it was like Lincoln's friend of his wife, you know, and his name is Charles. And he apparently warned him a few days before his assassination that there was danger and he was in danger of being killed. And Lincoln did not believe him. He did not take him seriously because he was a channeler of the dead, because he was a medium, because he kind of had him in this camp of like,
whoa,
all right, thank you, but you're my wife's weird friend. You know what I mean? That's kind of where he had put him in that box.
Like, Chuck, I just tread lightly, Chuck. Come on.
Totally.
Be real.
Totally. So then this is the interesting part, because when another friend warned Lincoln that vengeful Southerners might try to pull some stuff, might try to kill him, the president replied, oh, it's so funny, you know, Charles keeps telling me that. And turns out Charles wasn't telling him that because he was a little bit psychic. He might have been. We don't know how good of a medium he was. He was telling him that because Charles was good friends with John Wilkes Booth, the person who
killed
Lincoln. Yeah. So what's interesting about this, they bring up in the article, T article, the Semmelweis effect, and how similarly, like, this is an example of that. And what was interesting about this article is that you can hear this story and you can think, wow, Lincoln would not hear the truth, so he died. And Semmelweis spoke the truth and no one wanted to hear it, so he died, you know? So it can be the cynical perspective of like truth kills, but also, you know,
it's very dire.
Yeah. But I think it actually is really this, it goes beyond that more to to pivot quickly, you know? And I think we're going to talk about that in a more concrete business sort of a way, but with anything, it's not hearing the truth. It's not exploring it really. And there's this Carl Jung quote where he says that neurosis is always a substitute for legitimate suffering. And, you know, I think refusing to deal with inconvenient issues is it comes from a good place. You know what I mean? Like, it comes from this adaptive quality that's like, I just want to get through the day and I need to help Sam over here. So like, I'm just going to focus on that. I really can't deal with the fact that someone's trying to kill me right now, Charles, but thank you so much, you know? But really it's like, you know, we're all trying to do our best. And I think it is important to listen to these things, but also to figure it out in a way that works for us. So anyway, did you know that story?
No, I didn't. And I also love that Carl Jung quote. It makes me think of another concept, the identified patient in therapy. I think typically, I'm not a therapist, but what I know of this, in families where there's an addiction problem, there's often the identified patient, which is the addict, and everyone projects their worries and their own dysfunction onto that addict, and they're the center, they're the problem, they're the one everyone worries about, where everyone in the family still has their own levels of dysfunction and things that are wrong, but they can ignore them conveniently because they're focusing all their attention on this one person. And that's definitely some always reflex. Like we're always getting signs and some signals that like something might be amiss or dysfunctional with us, whether it's our health or our intuition, or even like the state of our home, how things are organized. If it's messy and cluttered, like that's a sign of dysfunction for a lot of people. So I like that you brought Carl Jung into it.
Yeah, I just felt like that between Semmelweis himself, that story, and this story, it really helped it concretely get into my brain on how I can use this knowledge in my own life. Hearing both those examples helped me. And yeah, I felt like that Carl Jung quote too, it really, and yours too, I feel like that concept brings us all together. So how can we use it?
That's a good question. I do have a story. I have a way to explain it. And then I have some like sort of theoretical things, existential things that you can take with you. So my story for using Semmelweis reflex is very recent. I have all these water bottles that I made. I made them like actually a couple of years ago. And I had to have a minimum order of like 500. And I ended up buying them and getting them. And I was like, I got to take pictures. I got to merchandise them. I got to make them really beautiful. I got to put them up on not Squarespace, but Shopify, because that's the way that I can sell things more easily. I just kept kicking the can down the road, and people would DM me all the time asking to buy a water bottle. And I'd be like, oh no, I haven't put the sales page up yet. I'll let you know when it's up. Literally hundreds of people have asked me to sell these freaking water bottles. There was just so much that I felt like I had to do that finally someone requested, and it was like the last straw. Also, we moved and I had to take these water bottles with us, and I was like, I need to get rid of these. Like, it is time to sell them and put them out in the world because they're awesome water bottles.
Yeah, I have one. They're great.
Yeah, they're great. And dude, I just put up a Venmo. I said, if you send me $30 and you write your address in the Venmo, like in the Venmo spot, I will send you a water bottle. And I sold like 40 water bottles. I didn't even put it up on Holisticism. I put it up on like my own personal page. I did not need to make a crazy, beautiful website and sales emails. And that's typically how I would do things, right? That's typically how I do business, very strategic and thoughtful and buttoned up. And I just was like, what if I just do things a little bit differently this time? The evidence is pointing to people just want this thing. Like, it ain't that deep. I don't need to make it so hard. Yeah. Let's make it a little bit more casual. And it worked out.
That's such a good example. And I really, first of all, that just is so relieving. Like, and same with Semmelweis himself. Like, wow, isn't it great that if you just wash your hands, it's going to help so much, you know, like it's counter, you know, it was a big deal back then. And same thing. I think there's been many examples in my life and my work where I've made something such a big deal in my mind and like, oh, but then I have to do step 17 and step 12. And so I'm not even going to do step 1 and 2 because those are really hard. And I'm all set. I'm going to quit now, you know? And and this is a really good example of what if we could just skip to all of those steps and just do the one at the very end and see how it goes. And it's great.
You just have to see what happens. It's just an experiment. It's okay if it doesn't work. You know, if it doesn't, then go back to your typical way of doing things. But that kind of brings us to how do we not fall prey to Semmelweis effect or Semmelweis reflex and immediately issue new information that's inconvenient for us. The first thing would just be to push on what your belief system is or what your worldview is. What's your meaning-making system? And I think to do that, you have to know what your worldview is. And I mean, we talk about that all the time. Here, we've done an episode on how to write your spiritual operating system. But I think knowing and articulating how you see the world gives you the opportunity to really investigate, well, how do I see the world? And why do I believe that thing? Did I inherit that belief from somebody else? Is that truly mine? Or is it just kind of something I never questioned for myself that I've believed to be true? That in and of itself would be experimenting with Semmelweis reflex. And then I just think like being curious, being genuinely curious. We were talking earlier about like, you know, wrestling or arguing about something like a concept, that a new piece of evidence or truth you've been invited to learn. I think instead of coming in defensive to and like you're going to bat for your beliefs, kind of just having an air of curiosity and of, oh, that's interesting. Huh, why do we believe that? Not in a snide way, but in a real, like, I want to understand way. Again, that's going to help you not feel so black or white in your thinking. And then, speaking of black or white thinking, just check these cognitive distortions for you. We've done an episode on this. Cognitive distortions like mind reading, catastrophizing, minimizing, the heaven's reward fallacy, which is the belief that good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad people because you deserve it, or black and white thinking, so lack of nuance. Just like when those pop up for you, might be a moment to say, huh, is there new evidence about the world that I'm receiving that might be unpleasant for me, that changes or makes me question the way I see things? Yeah. And I think just being like optimistically critical of new findings, whether that's research that's being published or information that you're learning or teachers that you're talking to. It's sexy to change your mind when you get new information. It's not sexy to join a cult on accident. So that's why we have to be, you know, we need to be a little bit critical. We can't just be like, yeah, everything is true. But to sort of blanket statement, be like, everything is bullshit. We can't trust anyone. That's also not fun. So just finding that happy medium.
Yeah. And not being afraid to say, maybe, good point. Let me do my own research and get some more sources and figure out the middle way.
That's true. The middle way. That's yeah. true. So that's Semmelweis reflex. I like this one. Katie, if you had to, a sun, moon, and rising for a Semmelweis reflex, what would you call it?
Oh, I love this part of the show as a listener. I'm so stoked that I get to be part of it. I think I would pick, he's definitely stubborn. He's for sure stubborn. So, and I know that typically Tauruses are what the have that in their chart. So I think there's got to be that in there.
Yeah.
And then he seems meticulous. So I would say there's got to be some Virgo in there because of the amount of experiments he did to try to make this work. And then I don't know. That's where I need your help. Where would you put those placements?
I mean, that sounds like on the P to V scale, he's Semmelweis reflex is pretty V, you know, but in a good way. Because I think Virgo is like the pursuit of knowledge. At least that's how I always think of Virgos. Like they want truth, you know? Whereas maybe Capricorn or Taurus might be a little bit more hard-headed about it. But I like that. Yeah, I think of the sun, moon, and rising archetype of Semmelweis reflex. I think doctor or researcher or scientist, someone who really is methodical, to your point, truth seeker probably, and then maybe a student, someone who's just always seeking knowledge, who wants to learn, who wants to find the truth. So I think that's how I'd probably categorize. When you think of the Semmelweis reflex, do you think it's a morning glory or a night owl?
I think night owl.
Okay. And then matcha or coffee?
I think black coffee. I thought about that one a lot over all my research.
I couldn't agree more. I was like, absolutely mainlining black coffee.
Hard yes.
All the time. Would you become an acolyte of the Semmelweis reflex? Are you going to implement it into your life, or is it something that you're going to tuck away for later?
Absolutely. I'm all in, and I'm going to handle it delicately in the ways that we discussed, but it's here to stay. How about you?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I like a framework that makes me question everything. You know, like I really like that. I like to live an examined life. That's like one of the things I love most about Judaism, is that it means to, you know, to wrestle with God or to wrestle. And so much of the Jewish faith and culture is wrestling with what do we believe? What is true? What is our experience of God and spirituality? And not just taking it at face value, but really questioning it ourselves. Because the more you question something, the more you understand it and wrestle with it. So yes, definitely. Long story short, definitely going to implement Semmelweis reflex in my own life.
I love that. Thank you for introducing me to this concept and all of us. And thank you for having me as first episode on mic with you as producer. I'm so grateful to be here. And thank you, all of you, for listening, because I know when there's a new person, I hope the openness we talked about here applies to that, because I know it can. I know for me, I'm sad Wallace is leaving. As a listener, I'm bummed myself. So I hope having a new person, I appreciate you being here.
I didn't even think about that. Yes, I'm Always Reflex is a perfect intro episode for you.
I know. It all came together. Well, we'll talk to you all soon. And if you want more of Michelle and I talking, there's plenty of it in the 12th house plus.
There's a lot of it. It's true. And there's more to come. Thanks for listening. As always, if you liked this episode, share it with your friends, send it to the group text, even share it on Instagram stories. If you're feeling really bold, we'll repost you. And if you could, if you could just smash that subscribe button and rate us with 5 stars on Spotify, that would be amazing and so helpful, and takes, 10 seconds. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye. See you guys next week.
Bye. The 12th House is produced by me, Katie Dalebout, with theme music by Nathan McKay and edited by the incredible Softer Sound Studio, who you can find more information about in our show notes.